Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today P.F. Kluge. His new novel is The Master Blaster, and he joins us by telephone from somewhere in central Ohio, I believe.
Well, yes, a small elite liberal arts college on a hill north of Columbus, about an hour, Kenyon College, from which I incidentally graduated in 1964.
Wow.
So you can do the math.
Okay. Well, I've read this new book, and I was just tickled that you set it on the island of Saipan, because I've always been intrigued with Saipan. And I understand that you were there with the Peace Corps and that you became intrigued, and you've been there many times since.
Exactly. It's odd. I finished graduate school in 1967. I was 25, had a University of Chicago PhD. And I applied to the Peace Corps, specifying an interest in Ethiopia and Turkey because they sounded like exotic countries with a lot of history and spicy food and markets and things, things that I could write about, like Lawrence Durrell or somebody. Mm-hmm. And then some nameless bureaucrat sent me to this little dot on the map of the Pacific, Saipan, 120 miles north of Guam. I knew almost nothing about it. And there wasn't, beyond some World War II history, an enormous amount to read. It had been a big battleground in July of 44. And the Enola Gay, Colonel Tibbetts' plane, had taken off for Hiroshima from the neighboring island 3 miles away of Tinian. So I went to this place not really knowing what I was getting. And I guess I fell in a kind of love with it. I had a good 2 years there. And I kept going back whenever I could, initially to work with some politicians who were negotiating the future political status of that place. Saipan was part of a trust territory of Pacific Islands, administered for the UN by the U.S. It became eventually a U.S. Commonwealth. I was there in the early years of the negotiations, and then whenever I was in the neighborhood or had a magazine assignment send me there, I stopped by Saipan. I could not bear to leave it any time, thinking it was a last trip. There was always going to be a next trip to Saipan, and those next trips have continued ever since. In 2004, I was there for the 60th anniversary of the World War II battle. They'd sent a ticket for me, and I gave a bit of a speech. And a few years ago, I was there on an NEH-sponsored sort of grant lecturing on American novels on Saipan for 6 weeks. I guess Huck Finn, The Things They Carried, The Old Man and the Sea, and To Kill a Mockingbird. So I keep going back, and it's someplace I think about. It's not like I live there, but it's a place that preoccupies me, and I have a sort of alternate life there.
You've written this novel from various viewpoints, and the first viewpoint that we get is from the title character, a mysterious fellow named the Master Blaster. And I'm guessing that perhaps you were inspired somewhat for this character by someone who has a website currently called SaipanSucks.com.
Yes. The site hasn't been updated since 2006, but I saw it, and it still pops up, and it's got lots of funny and controversial stuff about Saipan. And I eventually found, though I won't disclose, the identity of the proprietor of the site, and this person is not on Saipan now. He's elsewhere. But I posited the idea, suppose you had someone doing it on a small island with a tight weave of life, and everybody talks, and there are no secrets. Suppose you had this sort of person really risking life and limb to put out a website which outrages people. And in a way, he's exercising a kind of free speech at no monetary compensation for himself, and just sort of becoming, I don't know, something between the conscience of the island and, it, for the purposes of the novel, the stage manager in our town.
Mm. And from the sound of it, if there's one character in this book that might be a little bit like you, it would be the travel writer.
Well, yes, I'm still a contributing editor at National Geographic Traveler, and I've done a great deal of that. On the other, and of course, yes, there's a lot of me and George Griffin. I hope my writing is better than his and my, my career fair is better. But I did want to have a sort of an accomplished hack travel writer who aspires to be an elite travel writer like Paul Theroux or Pico Iyer, a guy with literary aspirations that his very commercial success prevents him from realizing. So a guy kind of caught in a trap, and he sort of bottoms out and takes a random junket to Saipan. So I'm in him, but I think I'm in all my characters, you know? I mean, they all have aspects of me, and I think a novel doesn't work if you're not in, at least a piece of you isn't invested in all of the characters. Bad as they may be, even the villains, maybe especially the villains. There's a quote of Goethe's that I like, that he'd never heard of a crime that he couldn't imagine himself committing. And that's the way I feel about my characters.
P.F. Kluge joins us. His new novel is The Master Blaster. All these characters are thrown together randomly, and they're delivered to Saipan on the same plane. And then we follow them, each one of them narrates what they're up to, and they're very different people. Let's talk about the different characters. We've already mentioned the travel writer.
Right. Well, let me say I borrowed the premise of the novel, that is four people converging as they approach a place. That device I saw in Graham Greene's novel about Papa Doc Duvalier's Haiti called The Comedians. There they meet on a ship and have a sort of glancing, and, you know, shipboard acquaintances, a glancing knowledge of each other, a little bit of inadvertent revelation, and go their separate ways, crossing paths occasionally. And their character is revealed, and their fate declares itself on Haiti. I wanted roughly that same thing happening on Saipan with always the Master Blaster kind of watching from a distance, but then, yes, the hack travel writer George Griffin, and then a Bangladeshi worker called Khan. After Saipan became a commonwealth, it became an outright U.S. territory. I think it's the last little burp of manifest destiny. There was a sort of boom time there, and property values rocketed, all sorts of investments came in. And people of fairly modest circumstances on Saipan had enough money to hire foreign laborers. At the time, Filipina maids were $150 a month and Bangladeshi farmers, 80 or so. And I have one of those coming to Saipan on the presumption that, well, we're under the American flag. This is a kind of backdoor Ellis Island. In fact, it was not and is not. But, you know, that's the hope. So I wanted to have a Bangladeshi knocking around the island. And then the island still attracts characters who are looking for a second chance, who believe in that old dream of island, a simpler life in a small place, a sort of a way of grasping ultimate meanings and maybe relaxing and escaping predators, ex-spouses, or debts back home. And so I had a teacher come, a professor, who, though she professes loving classroom experiences, is in fact ambitious to become a college administrator and senses an opening at a community college on Saipan. And then I have a sort of a flim-flam man, a sort of entrepreneur, a kind of bit of a huckster, but a likable fellow who wants to do a resort on Saipan. And they all discover that islands are not simple, they are far more complicated than expected, that these people have been seeing all sorts of foreigners wash up on their shores forever. There have been people on Saipan looking for Spanish galleons and succeeding, the wrecks of them. Hmm. There are people on Saipan who've tried to find Amelia Earhart, who once was thought had been imprisoned there. There's a guy who came to Saipan wanting to lift George Herbert Walker Bush's airplane from World War II off the bottom of the ocean with government support. So, you know, they keep coming, all these people, these characters. Jack Abramoff was a lobbyist out there. I mean, people come because it's inviting. You're under the American flag. U.S. dollars are used. People mostly speak English. And so it's not like trying to penetrate China or Japan. You know, it's a sort of congenial place for a certain kind of American to gravitate. And those characters show up. And so I wanted to have one or two of those.
P.F. Kluge joins us. His novel is The Master Blaster. I love The Master Blaster, but I think if I had to pick a favorite character, it would be the Flim Flam Mam Man. And he works for someone who's quite a bit like Jack Abramoff.
Yes, I'll agree. There have been other Abramoffs and similar people, but yes, yes, that's true. He has, I guess, through a left-handed sort of marriage relationship, he has a connection with someone who has lobbied on behalf of the islands for special exemptions and privileges at the time they became a commonwealth, and that was roughly, among other things, one of the roles that Jack Abramoff had working for the Northern Marianas. Yes,
I think one of my favorite moments featuring this character is when he's going over to the nearby island of Tinian, where the Enola Gay was ultimately going to be taking off from, and he runs into this ancient veteran in a wheelchair,
yeah,
who knew his father, and I love that part.
I have been to Saipan, and you know those, they may be reclaimed by the military completely, but to these days, most of the time, you can get to those four runways that the B-29s used, and you can get to the loading pit from which the atomic bombs were hoisted into the bellies from down below the level of the ground into those B-29s that went to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And at night, I used to go there. This is sort of a guilty confession, in my rented car, and you'd drive through the boonies. You didn't know, have to know where to turn onto a bumpy dirt road. And then suddenly you're up. You're on a runway. You have it to yourself, and one of the runways, with the exception of a few saplings that have taken root here and there, you can drive on. And I'm not the kind of guy who normally does this sort of things, but on the right night with the moon shining, I would turn off the headlights and speed down that strip, you know. And it's as close as I've come to an out-of-body experience. So Tinian is there, and I've been with veterans returning to Tinian, and I realize how emotionally charged it is for them. So it was easy, and I've been to all the locations there that figure in the book, and I could easily imagine a conversation with such a veteran. I've seen enough of these fellows when they come back. Alas, the time for that's probably passing, but I saw them, a whole bunch of them, when I was there in 2004, including Paul Tibbetts, who at the age of 90-something came to give a speech on Saipan pretty shortly before his death.
And he was from Columbus.
Yeah, he lived in Bexley. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My dad was in the 2nd Division, Marine Corps. He was there in July of 1944. He was part of the force that came in and took the island, and he never liked talking about it. And then he had a couple of strokes, and he started talking about it. And there were a lot of really horrible things that happened. And you allude to some of these in your book. Well, we have a couple murders that happen, but there's also a congressman who discovers a terrible thing as he's touring the battlegrounds, and it's devastating for him. And I remember my dad talking about some of the things that went on, and it was no mystery to me that so many of the Japanese occupiers chose suicide rather than to be captured because they were so afraid of the Americans.
Yes, and if you read books like Dower's War Without Mercy, you realize that not many prisoners were taken. And though an effort was made to induce the Japanese to surrender on Saipan, it failed. And so at the north end of the island, you had all sorts of people jumping off cliffs. And there were two cliffs, one called Suicide Cliff, is several hundred feet high at the north end of the island, and they jumped off of that onto land down below. And then at the edge of the sea in that same area, there's something called Bonsai Cliff, and they jumped there into water. And there is film of that, and it was a horrific occasion. And I've heard that it was the biggest mass suicide until Jim Jones passed out Kool-Aid in Jonestown.
The book is The Master Blaster. P.F. Kluge wrote it. He joins us on the program today. And I'm sure we have listeners who are familiar with your other books. In fact, a couple of them were made into motion pictures, weren't they?
Well, a magazine article I co-authored at Life magazine, shortly before Life magazine, in its weekly incarnation, went out of business, involved reconstructing a bank robbery that had occurred in Brooklyn and had pretty quickly become a hostage situation. I didn't witness it, but I talked to people afterwards and put it together with another reporter, and that became Dog Day Afternoon.
Whoa.
With Al Pacino. And the other work that's made it to film, a lot of stuff gets optioned routinely, and you're glad that it's out there, and you think about it when you're shaving in the morning, but you don't really expect to see anything. And frequently, you don't, except for a small check at the start. But Eddie and the Cruisers, my second novel, which was about rock and roll and my home state of New Jersey, became a film which, though it technically, they tell me, never made any money, it nonetheless does well on television and has almost a cult following. I get letters about who was the real Eddie and that sort of thing. Was I ever playing in a band myself on the Jersey Shore? The answer is no. Mm. But, yeah, I hear from that all the time, and I'm delighted when it happens. I don't write novels with a view to their being readily adaptable to film. But when it happens, it gets my attention because, alas, the shelf life of a book in a store is somewhere between milk and yogurt. and, you know, movies in a mutated form, admittedly, give your work a renewed life. And I'm for that. I welcome that.
And Eddie and the Cruisers had a great soundtrack, too.
Yes, yes. That and although it wasn't enough to save the movie in theaters when it later... I have I'm the only member of the Kenyon faculty who has a double platinum record at home on the wall of the office.
Wow. That one went double platinum.
Yeah.
I knew it did really well.
It did well. And you know, wherever I am around the world, it's like one of these weird things. You know, I could be sitting in Gmunden, Austria, and I hear On the Dark Side from Eddie and the Cruisers come over the jukebox. It finds me.
Have you ever written a travel article pretending that you were a woman?
No, but I love the device. You're referring to an incident in the book where the hack travel writers... only way of writing a serious book. They like his proposal, but they don't like his track record, and they want him to disassociate himself from the project. And as their commercial sophisticated choice to write the book is a woman named Amelia Bly, who is an invention, an alternate voice, an alternate outlet of the hack writer himself. This gets very complicated, and it struck me as a charming device. And I do realize in traveling that men and women have different, obviously this is a cliche, different experiences and different angles. And I like that voice. It came naturally to me.
The Master Blaster is an enigmatic character, and we learn later in the book that he's really dealing with his own mortality here. And when we discover how he's infiltrated just about everything in the island, this guy, you talk about him looking at things from a distance, but sometimes the distance isn't that far, is it?
Right. He's involved in the island. And, you know, in the Times Review of my book, Janet Maslin said it was a love letter to a maddening island. And I think... the Master Blaster himself loves the place, and is maddened by it. So it's a rich mixture of feelings that he has. He knows it intimately. He's regarded as a saintly figure by many people. He sends kids off on scholarships. But nonetheless, he has the gravest reservations about the way the island is turning with its interests in gambling casinos and tourism and all that sort of thing, that desperation to pay for an American lifestyle, especially since they became a U.S. Commonwealth. So he's a complicated guy, and his motives are tangled, but I find it a rich mix, and I find him an engaging character.
And there's one character who looms over all this, and he doesn't narrate anything, but he keeps turning up, and he's sort of the Master Blaster's protege in a way, but he's also like Lucifer.
Yes, that was the hardest character to write, because the academic, the travel writer, the Master Blaster, the investor, I know those guys. I've seen them. I have a sense of what they're like, and I could get close enough in my head to the Bangladeshi worker. But the Master Blaster, I wanted someone who incarnated the good and the bad of the island, who protects it, exploits it, is evasive, deals with and has a sort of philosophical take on what it is to live like an island, on an island. And it involves opportunism and courtesy. You begin to realize, you know, there are places that make history and there are places that receive history. And when you're on a small island, you're on the receiving end of whatever comes along. In the case of Saipan, the Spanish, the Germans, the Japanese, the Americans, and now a sort of quasi-Commonwealth status with the United States. You can't control who comes. You can't stop them at the beaches. But you can sort of affect the quality of their stay, as he says. So he's a bit of an operator and a businessman, but he also, in a way, is stressing the resistance of the islands to some change and their eagerness to cash in on other changes. He's a complicated and thoughtful man with streaks of evil and of generosity in him. And he's probably the character that I had to work hardest to get. I'm not saying he's not realistic, but he's the most imagined character in the book.
And there are these elements of darkness. There's, of course, the shadow of the war. And there's essentially sweatshop labor going on. There's slave labor. There's sexual slavery.
The novel set in 2004, yeah.
And I didn't realize that there were so many Russians, particularly women, that come there.
That's fairly recent, yeah, but they're there, and there are Russian tourists, and they love it. As for the Japanese, it's their closest Florida. It's the warm weather place to get to Saipan and Guam in the winter for fairly low fee. And the Russians just love it, and I'm by no means saying just that there are prostitutes. There are Russians of all kinds, but you do see Russian prostitutes around, yes, among others. And the garment industry has shut down now utterly. There was a change in the trade laws, but there were once about three dozen places with women from mainland China mainly and other countries living in barracks, and you know, they were working on shirts and dresses that were stamped made in USA or made in Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas. Odd things keep showing up on islands. It's a funny thing. Saipan is just a place that from Magellan onward seems to be history keeps showing up.
And there were actually Southern congressmen who tried to tell their constituents that it was a good thing that they were bringing all these Chinese into Saipan because...
I think Tom DeLay's been quoted from Texas, has been quoted as saying that Saipan was a petri dish of capitalism.
There you go. And they also wanted them to be Christians.
Well, they are. I mean, that's what they've been since the Spanish came. So that it wasn't necessary to make that effort. That's what they are.
I'm referring to the Chinese they were bringing in.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. Apparently, they were bringing them in, and they wanted them to be influenced by the Christianity on the island after coming from this heathen land.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see. Well, that doesn't surprise me.
Well, I think another character, I'd almost forgotten about him. He's a peripheral character, but I love this guy. And it's the older Japanese man at this sort of closed hotel. What a wonderful character he is.
Yeah, I wanted the Japanese have an attachment to Saipan because from World War One on to the to 1944, this was part of the Japanese South Sea Empire called Nanyocho, and some people would say that if the war had not come along, and there in a few more generations, the Saipanese would have been a kind of Japanese in the way that Okinawans are. And they were on their way to being assimilated. And the Japanese built lovely towns. They had a sort of busy island, lots of sugar cane being grown. They built railroads. It was quite an interesting world, and so they were quick to return to it. I was in the Peace Corps there in 67 when the first Japanese came back. Many of them, early groups, were bone hunters. The Japanese placed great value on returning the remains of the war dead to Japan, and they were going into caves at the north end of the island, caves that had been blasted shut in the fighting and had entombed some Japanese soldiers. There were you could wander the boondocks even then, and to this day, I think, and find Japanese mess kits and canteens and those rubber sandals they used to wear, cooking pots. So the Japanese came back, and some Japanese definitely had an attachment of love to the place. It was where they grew up sometimes, and I had one Japanese running a hotel there and tending a garden and realizing, basically he says that the sovereignty has changed, or the, you know, administrations and foreign conquerors come and go. A place belongs to the people who love it.
Mm.
And that is his position. I find it admirable because I love it too, and I don't pretend to own land there.
Well, I love the book. Our guest today has been P.F. Kluge. His new novel is The Master Blaster. We really appreciate your time, sir.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. Next week, we'll have a gem of a novel for you. It's The Lord God Bird. It was written by Tom Gallant. Tom is a singer, a actor, a TV guy. He sailed his schooner 50,000 miles around the world. And he's just a really interesting man. This is his first novel. And two main characters are the man and a woodpecker. Tom Gallant with The Lord God Bird. Next week, right here in The Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.